Welcome to the Water Resources Podcast. I'm your host, Bridget Scanlon, from the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin. This podcast is produced in partnership with the National Academy of Engineering. In this podcast, we discuss water challenges with leading experts.
Hi, everybody. I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Esteban Jabagi as our guest today on the podcast. Esteban, thank you so much for joining us. And can you please describe where you work and your background a little bit?
Sure. Thanks, first of all, for letting me be here with you discussing interesting topics. I am getting into this conversation from the other side of the world, I would say. I'm in San Luis, which is a small town in Argentina. I work in an institute, which is part of the University of San Luis, and is funded by the National of Argentina, which is named CONICET. By training, I am an agronomist, and I work on both sides of the fence, I would say, on production and environment issues related to agriculture and production in land ecosystems in general.
Wonderful. So I would like to mention that Esteban won the prestigious HU Award, Ambassador Award in 2018 for his work with farmers and I guess what we would term now as co-production of knowledge with stakeholders and farmers. And I really admire that aspect of your work, that you have boots on the ground and you're talking to the people working the land. And I also appreciate the documentaries you shared with me recently on issues in Argentina. Very powerful images for the dry Chaco issues and the Pampas. So thank you so much. Today, we would like to talk a little bit about some of the recent hazards that Argentina has been exposed to, the Corrientes wildfires, and then talk about agricultural expansion in Argentina and impacts on water resources, what Esteban thinks could be a future for more sustainable development. So maybe first let's talk about the Corrientes wildfires.
Yes, I think fires are ringing a bell in South America during these times, in many places and for different reasons. But the Corrientes fires are interesting. Those fires take place in the eastern, northeast of Argentina, in relatively humid land that is still covered in great part by grasslands and wetlands. And those fires, we have never seen fires like those. They are a new extreme that we are reaching. Early, the convergence of two important things is hitting the system. First of all, is the local climate. We have a very strong drought. But second, many of these wetlands depend on a larger system, which is the Paraná River basin. And we had extremely low levels in the Paraná River. All this is clearly coming from La Niña influence. With La Niña events, we have lower than normal precipitation. I would add something else on top of this, and it's that Corrientes is showing an interesting paradox. The number one biome that produces timber products and pulp in Argentina is the grassland. Most of the tree plantations, rapid growth tree plantations that we have are located. And these fires, when they reach these plantations, they get incredible proportions. The temperature and the magnitude is much higher than what you see in the grassland. So the combination of these things make these fires a unique thing. Something bad, but also something good in the sense that society really starts paying attention to the problem of climate change and the carbon cycle, conservation, production, and the important effect of fires.
Right. So I agree with you. They ring a bell and they get people's attention, and we can't waste a good disaster in trying to make good policies for the future. I understand maybe 70,000 cattle were lost, 550 million losses in agriculture. So huge losses, and then also impacts on the biodiversity of the region and the national park, the Ibira National Park. 60% of that was burned. So huge impacts.
Yes, there's on one side these hard and clear impacts on the economy. For example, if you lose tree plantations that were growing for the last 10 years, all at once, it's a big hit. If you lose your cattle, it's really important. But also there are these more symbolic, I would say, impacts that are very important in the urban part of the society, which is the biggest one in South America in general, and the more powerful one, one that has more influence. And the images of the fire damaging wildlife in the Iberá National Park, and the smoke of this, of some of these fires reaching large cities, are really driving a lot of attention and making people in the cities to the way in which we are managing the whole system. So in that sense, I think this is an opportunity to do something about how we manage the land and how we work with climate change, how we adapt, and to some extent, how we mitigate it.
Right. So there's a lot of discussion these days about, you know, the energy prices increasing impacts on fertilizer production and food security globally. So maybe you can give us a little bit of a picture of where Argentina stands, how vulnerable they are, or how resilient they are to these issues.
Yeah, I would say that the farming systems of Argentina, although they may seem very similar to what you see, for example, in the main agricultural belt of the US and Canada, are quite different in a sense. You see the same soybean, the same maize, but the economic, political, and social context is very different. So our systems, for example, are some of the least fertilized farming systems of the world. They also have relatively low consumption of fossil fuels because we do no-till agriculture. That means that you don't use a lot of machinery. You rely much more on herbicides than on fuel. So our system is uniquely resilient to the crisis of energy prices that we see, or even to the fertilizer crisis that we are seeing and we may see increasing in the next years. That's another interesting thing about agriculture in the plains of Argentina is the very low use of fertilizer, which I would say has two results. First of all, the soils are still very fertile and can still yield of their load of nutrients to crops without being replenished. That won't last forever, of course. And second, economic and taxation context of agriculture in this part of the world.
And can you describe a little bit about the economic and taxation, how that differs in Argentina from other regions a little bit?
Yes, it's interesting. You see that in the US and Europe, Eastern, Western Europe mainly, China, of course, and India to some extent, the agricultural belts are highly subsidized by the society. Money that comes from other sectors ends going to farming through subsidies. What you see in Argentina is exactly the opposite. The farming sector is actually highly taxed. Numbers change depending on how you calculate them, but they are 50% of the revenue of the gross revenue goes to the government, and that sector of the economy is subsidizing other sectors. So agriculture is subsidizing industrial sectors, infrastructure, and other sectors of the economy. So that context means that the profit of grain production is smaller once you discount the tax. And the strategy of farmers under this context is to reduce costs as much as they can. And that is one of the reasons I think we have this system that is still relying on mining the natural stock of nutrients in soils. It's also targeting relatively, I wouldn't say low, but mid-level production numbers or yield, you know, the highest possible yields, because that's the way you reduce risk and you reduce costs also. And another thing that's interesting, we don't fertilize a lot and we don't irrigate almost at all our farming systems, our grain production systems. But there are very few countries that go through this context of high taxation. We are the champions of taxation to crops. Next, I would say, comes Ukraine. That's interesting. That's the center of the conflict we see today in the global level. And another country that has some resemblance to Argentina is Australia, where there's small taxation and certainly no subsidies for agriculture.
And so the farmers pay about 30% tax on exported soybeans. Is that correct? Something like that?
Yes, yeah. It's a 30% that you pay. Actually, the way it works, and that's how it works very well for a national state, is that you charge the exporter at the port, and the exporter immediately transfers that cost to the farmer. And there's no way to escape that. It's very hard to load a ship with soybean without paying your taxes. You can do it, and some people do it, but it's difficult, and the government is quite good at charging that tax. But then there are some other taxes. There are some provincial taxes, the local taxes that you pay. So if you ask a farmer that's good at making numbers, the farmer would say that they are losing about 50 or even 60% of their gross revenue, or the revenue that they should have if they look at the international price of soybean and maize because of these taxes.
Well, that leads us to the topic of agricultural expansion, which has really taken off since over the past two decades, since about 2000. Maybe you can describe some of the drivers that initiated that or that really expanded it, Mr. Bond.
Yeah, perhaps to connect it with the previous topic, the subsidies and the taxes. The taxes are certainly not a driver. Actually, they are restraining expansion. So that's interesting. It suggests that without taxes, the expansion would be much, much faster than what it is today. And in the discussion of taxation or subsidies, this is an important issue. So agriculture expands really fast in Argentina, and it expands over different types of land. Perhaps the most emblematic one is deforestation, farming expanding over forests. But there's also expansion over grasslands, natural grasslands, and over pastures, the planted pastures or cattle raising pastures that are disappearing fast in the core of the Pampas to give place to this agriculture system where basically we just go from soybean to maize and back to soybean and so on. We have one of the fastest deforestation processes in the world here. Basically, what we see is that agriculture is moving west, and that means it's moving towards drier areas. By doing so, it displaces what we call dry forests. They are forests, woodlands, shrublands that are disappearing quite fast and creating a lot of conflicts and tension. They are the place for wildlife. They are a source of livelihoods for many people. But they also are sitting on really fertile land. That's prime land for agriculture. Actually, I'm telling you that we are able to farm without fertilizing almost at all, without irrigating, paying a lot of taxes, and it's still a good machine. This is really, really good land for agriculture. And that's bad news for the trees and for the people that want the trees there.
So you did some really nice documentaries on the Gran Chaco region in the north, where you see a lot of deforestation. And it's fascinating to look at the Google Earth images, and you can see after 2000, large swaths of land converted to agriculture. So what enabled them to expand so much and what drove them? I mean, you mentioned soybeans, you mentioned no-till and herbicides, other things that made that transition.
Yeah, it's a combination of many things, and some come from the global level. The rising demand of grain to feed animals, basically, at the core of the food system today, is the cheapest, most efficient way of producing protein that then we use to feed porks, the pork we eat or the chicken we eat. And also, there's technological drivers. Development of Roundup-resistant soybean in the particular case of Argentina play a very important role. It makes doing agriculture in dry land quite simpler than before. You can control weeds very easily because your crop is resistant to a relatively cheap and wide spectrum herbicide, which is glyphosate. And you can keep the residue of the previous crop on top of the surface. That's good for water. So by controlling weeds very efficiently and having cover over the soil all year round, you are in a way encouraged to go farther west to drier land and keep doing soybean. That was very successful. There's other things also. There's a financial aspect on this transition, and there was a series of bank collapses in the banking system in Argentina in the early 2000s, and people didn't want to put their money in the bank anymore. And there was money around the system that was finding a good place to invest. and agriculture was one of them. So suddenly there was a lot of money flowing to small farming companies that were not owning land, but renting land. And suddenly we're accessing a lot of capital. They had a new technology that was working very well. And there were not big restrictions to transform the land from forest pasture or grassland to farmland. And it was the perfect storm, I would say, for the expansion of agriculture at a very, very fast rate. All of this is happening in a world that in the international trade of food products after year 2000.
Right. And then they also had a very efficient way, a mechanized way of removing the trees with chains, and they developed that system. And then, of course, that has negative impacts on the land that you still see today.
Yes, this is something, perhaps the saddest part of this process comes with the machinery as a symbol of how we do this. We develop machines that do it really fast, efficiently. Some key thing with business of agriculture in this context of taxes and all the things we were discussing is scale, economies of scale. So doing it at a very large scale makes it a lot more profitable. So you need to clear land at a fast pace, at a large scale, cut the trees, and we burn them in situ, and just keep going. And we don't, this is a triple tragedy. We are damaging the soil because we cut all the biomass and burn it in situ with very high temperature fires. We are losing the forest and we are not taking any advantage of these timber products that have a lot of value. I mean, some of these trees have valuable timber. So it's a waste in many aspects. And it's just the result of the rush to clear the land and to do it before someone stops you.
Right. So that brings us to the forest laws that became effective in 2008 and maybe at different times in the different provinces. So it was a national forest law then that's implemented by the provinces. Maybe you can describe that a little bit and how that might actually be exacerbating or amplifying some of the issues with deforestation and making them do it so rapidly.
Yeah, it's an interesting process. We don't have a lot of public land in Argentina, and we don't have a lot of land planning. So the forest law was something new and very important in the history of Argentina. A few years after this explosion of agriculture, mainly urban societies start getting concerned and protesting about the deforestation. And it was probably the marches in the towns that moved legislators to pass this law at the national level that asks each province to define which forests are going to be protected, strictly protected, which forests are going to be used but without clearing, are going to be allowed to get cleared compared to whatever, mainly agriculture. So this is a traffic light system that suggests to paint in red what you are going to preserve, yellow what you're going to be using as a forest, agreeing what you can do, whatever you want. And then after this law was passed, it was a big success. We went through this long process in which each province had to actually define the map. It was proposed as a participatory process. It wasn't that participatory in some of the provinces. Argentina is a federal country. Each province has total power on what it does with the land. To this day, in some provinces, the law has been effective, and a lot of trees are there thanks to their red or yellow color. But in other provinces, what we have seen is actually a speed up of deforestation because the information that the law enforces at some point makes you hurry up and clear the land before that happens. If you are the owner of a nice piece of potentially good land for farming that has trees, you may want to clear fast and get the money that you may earn from that before they ban it.
Right. I mean, there is some movement to pay for environmental services, but that doesn't really cover the cost. And when you clear the land, the value of the land triples or more than triples. And so the payment for environmental services is not really very effective.
Yeah, I think it will always run behind the amazing profitability of farming. always. I mean, we have in this law the mechanism to pay for the service of having your forest as a red. It never happened. And the values are ridiculous, are very low. And imagine, we are saying that we cannot keep pace with agriculture today. Imagine if the commodity prices go up or we low down the taxes on agriculture, even if we pay subsidies, imagine that. Then the profitability would go even higher. So I don't see the payment for services as a mechanism that will work, at least in the next decade.
Right. So, I mean, with all this land use change, then you see large-scale impacts on the water resources. Maybe you could describe that a little bit.
Yeah, and that's where I put most of my energy as a scientist, in understanding the water cycle under these big, big changes in land cover and land use. We got a few surprises that I think are surprises for us here, but also everyone working with water and land use. In the plains, when we slowly replace the native grasslands with pastures rotating crops, we didn't see a lot of changes. But with this fast expansion of agriculture, what we are seeing is that there is a larger leftover of water in the plain. Your crops are consuming less than what the pastures and the grassland before were consuming. And to say it in a different way, we need less rainfall to flood the plains than before. So we are seeing a lot of flooding and groundwater levels getting closer and closer to the surface. And this trend has been going on for the last 3 decades, and it's creating interesting tensions. On one hand, it was highly celebrated by farmers at the beginning because these water tables get closer to the surface, are a source of water for the crop in the short term, and can actually save you in a drought. We have seen that. We have seen that in 2017. We had a La Niña with the drought, and that saved us. And we produced a lot more than what we expected because of the contribution of these water tables to the crops. But at the same time, same water tables that get close to the surface favor flooding and waterlogging, and they cut roads, they damage towns, and with time, when a dry year comes after a wet year, you start seeing soils popping up in the surface of some of the farming land. So basically, what I see is that we are entering a new hydrological state in the system, which much shallower water tables, and that good aspects for farming, which isn't the main driver of this change, and some not so good aspects for the rest of the sectors in the landscape, like infrastructure, towns, and cattle raising as well, because when you get flooded, for example, dairy farms are really hit. You cannot take the milk out every day, and it damages a lot more the other sectors than farming.
Right. I think, you know, we've seen similar issues happen in the Southwest US, but it was over 100 years ago. The same in Australia, you know, with changing from native vegetation, which has deep roots and was evapotranspiring a lot of water. And then you change that to shallow rooted crops. And so you get increased to recharge and water tables rising. But maybe the pampas of that region, the topography is so flat. It's 1 in 1,000, you said, you know, earlier.
Yes, yeah.
And so then the water doesn't move and the water tables rise and then you get flooding.
We have been learning a lot about your work in southwestern US and the work of others in Australia and trying to make sense of what we see here by comparing with other regions. And one key thing is what you mentioned. These plains are so, so flat. We are in one of the flattest corners of the world. I call them hyperplains. These are sedimentary pockets within continents that many of them, the flattest ones, have a very strong influence of wind shaping the surface. And that creates a landscape that's very flat and also very bad at transporting water in the surface. It's actually, when you have these aeolian landscapes, imagine sand dunes, it's like having one dam after the next, and the water moves very slowly across those landscapes. And it's funny to see farmers, when they get flooded, they try to get the water out and they make these canals that that's them, they don't work very well. They fight with each other because they want to get rid of this extra water. Anyway, it's very hard to get the water out from such a flat place. Perhaps the good news for us when we compare to Australia, which has larger slopes than us, is that Australia has been collecting salts in their soils for millions of years. Our soils are much newer. Our stock of salts is not as huge as the Australian stock of salt. That's good for us. I mean, it will make it less painful in terms of land degradation. But we need to cope with this big bowl of sediment that is getting full of water now.
So I noticed one story recently about the Rio Nuevo, that river that formed overnight and then damaged roads and also impacted towns. So it was getting a lot of news interest and will help maybe with some of these issues and trying to reduce deforestation and have better land use practices to reduce flooding.
Yeah, Rio Nuevo is an amazing creature. It's something really bizarre that happened on the edge of the plain, close where the slopes start to get a little bit higher, close to some small mountains we have in the center of the plains, close to where I live. And it began as a very shy creek that opened overnight and was a segment of a few kilometers. But the curious thing was that this was a sapping, was a collapse, it was erosion from the bottom up to the surface and not the other way. This river opened overnight, was, as I said, shy, but in wet years, it kept growing. Today is a canyon of 80 meters width, 25 meters deep, and about 30 kilometers long. Now it's getting connected with a river that goes all the way across the Pampas. And this happened all in 20 years. It's quite shocking. Besides the bizarre aspect of it, it's interesting that when it started breaking roads, it cut the main corridor, west-east corridor of Argentina. Two roads were cut by this river. It was a big emergency. For a week, transport couldn't go through those roads. And then it got close to a town. That's when society reacted. The river is also very interesting because once you look at the sediments in the river, you realize that there was a river there before. Because at about 10 meters depth, you see sediment that was brought by water. But the age of that sediment, 1,000 years. Since then, there was no signs of fluvial activity all the way to the present. So this river is telling us that something really new is happening in the water balance of this river. So the combination of things make it a very unique case. It's just one weird phase of something that's very widespread and common here, which is rising water table levels. There was an interesting reaction. This happened in the province of San Luis, where I live. And the first thing the government did was to paint red all the pieces of forest that at that point were painted green and were allowed to get cut. So there was an interesting reaction. There were a few other reactions, but I think it's an interesting process, not only in terms of the natural mechanisms, but also in terms of how people react to these things.
Right, yeah. And so, I mean, that leads us to what other things you think they can do to preserve the land and to reduce the negative impacts on water resources. You know, do you have ideas to make more sustainable managements, more sustainable development in terms of
yes.
water quantity and salinity and all of these issues?
Yes, in the plains, I think we need to find ways to get out of this very low-cost, mid-yield target agriculture that is generating a huge leftover of water. Where everywhere else in the world, everyone's worried about farmers using too much water. Our tolerance is the opposite. They should use a little bit more. There are ways of doing that within the farming system. So one level of reactions or responses to this would be to have farming systems that adapt to water availability in a more flexible way. For example, you had a couple of wet years. Your water tables are very close to the surface. This is a good time to do double cropping and use more water. And if you can have one secondary crop that grows in a short period but has relatively deep roots, that would be great because you can load down the water table. And we are exploring things. We are learning that some cover crops or as they call it them today, service crops, can do that job. So that's interesting. If you are going through dry years, your water table goes down, then you can slow down and have your single crop again. So this adaptive agriculture is one of the ways out. Then at a larger level, this is the level of a plot of land. At the level of landscapes, we are learning that by preserving about 30, 40% of the forest, you can balance the groundwater system in the plains. Exactly at what scale? It's going to be a large grain or small grain, but well, it depends on the type of sediments that you have. But that can work also as a way to regulate the hydrology of the system. The problem when you get to this level is that you need to put to work together many farmers. You need agreements and you need organization. That takes a lot more effort. I feel better about controlling water than people in this sense. And it's going to be difficult. And the next level would be watersheds and big chunks of the plain, where we may work together with these land use strategies and perhaps some hydraulics, some work with canals and reservoirs. But I would always start from the side of vegetation and nature in this context of it.
I realize it's more of a social problem. Then, I mean, it would be difficult to get the farmers to do some of these things. Most of the farming is done by big agribusinesses. Is that correct? And most of these are renting the land for short periods of time. And so it would be difficult to... Maybe the government could incentivize it in some ways, but then what we saw from payment for environmental services to reduce deforestation, they don't put that much money into those programs. So... it would be difficult.
Yeah, it's interesting. We had a nice experiment in that regard. I agree with you. It's very difficult. And a lot of the land is rented. Actually, way more than half of the land is not managed by or under production by the owners, but by larger operations that rent the land from owners. So your link with the land is more volatile in that sense. And if you don't like this piece of land because it gets too flooded too frequently, you just go somewhere else. And that's a really bad thing for socio ecosystems, the lack of this volatility. But on the other hand, we have seen a very interesting policy in one of the provinces here, Cordoba province, where they are implementing what they call good practices of farming. And they are giving companies or farming companies points that they can use to reduce some of the provincial taxes. And it's working. So if that's implemented at a national level with a big chunk of taxes, there can be amazing things we can do. If we can move part of those taxes towards incentives for good practices, for the things that we consider valuable for the sustainability, conservation of the plains, I think it could work. We need to be more creative and we need to discuss more and take advantage of this nested governance systems of nations and provinces, which some people think is bad, but I think it's and resilience to develop these type of things.
I know you've also written some papers on diet and stuff, and you probably have some viewpoints. I mean, Argentina has a lot of livestock and meat eating is pretty high. So I would like to hear, you know, breeders may be interested in how they can change their lifestyle to maybe make it sustainable. And put your thoughts on that. I mean, it varies by regions and stuff.
20 years ago, or even more, 30 years ago, I was in the U.S. and I was surprised by how many vegetarians there were there. I was sure that would never happen. And it's actually happening. So diets, the youngest people in Argentina, they are discussing a lot about what you should eat or not, for your own health, for the environment, for the equity amongst people in our society, in the world. But still, we are very, very big meat eaters. And actually, one interesting thing, we rely on grain to get revenue for the government, and we tax that. With meat, we do the opposite. We close exports of meat so we can keep the price of meat low. No government wants the price of meat to go very high because you lose the next election. So we have this perfect place to eat cheap, excellent meat. here. But this is another discussion. And on the footprint of beef, the environmental footprint of beef is growing as we use more and more grain to finish animals. It's not like the US, where a lot of the mass of meat that you eat is coming from grain, but it's going in that direction. So there's quite a lot of discussion today on about how much meat we should eat and what type of usually. And Uruguay is well ahead of Argentina in that sense. Uruguay is already branding its meat as grass-fed meat and trying to conquer markets abroad that way. I think this is going to come in to Argentina at some point, but it's still under debate. And of course, surprises come faster than we expect, and we may be more vegetarian in the future. But there's something to consider there. When we were making numbers about the footprint of different food items, the surprise was that vegetarian diet, an affluent vegetarian diet, which you can eat, for example, a lot of almonds, a lot of fruits, well, that diet has a very high water footprint because a lot of those crops come from irrigated land in Argentina. So we need to balance things. I mean, there's not a single solution or a single footprint that we can use everywhere.
I agree with you, Esteban. I mean, many years ago, I used to tout that we should all be vegetarians. But then I began to realize that, well, should I be eating almonds from California, where it takes a gallon to grow an almond, versus beef from Nebraska? Or, you know, it's more complicated and more nuanced than just simply changing diet. It depends on the source. And we need to consider that and the impacts of the crop production and the animal production in different regions. So I was wondering if you have any views on sustainability, you know, whether we should be trying to go from a top-down approach or a bottom-up, or, you know, and trying to develop more sustainably in the future.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think climate change has been the main player pushing the agendas of sustainability in the top-down pathway. And IPCC is perhaps the best example of that. How the whole world is going to try to orchestrate so number one environmental crisis that we are facing. And I'm kind of skeptic and disappointed, I would say, about this pathway. After so many years of reading IPCC reports that are very, very, we are not reacting fast and well. But when you look at bottom-up discussions of sustainability, I think they work much better. And they also help us escape this problem that we were discussing before with the water footprints. The water footprint of rice in Pakistan and rice produced in Uruguay cannot be the same. 1 gallon of water in one place or the other has different values. And so all the top-down approaches face that difficulty. And the bottom-up approaches, I see them moving really well in different contexts. So being in a country that's in the periphery of the world, like Argentina, and having problems that when I try to compare them with what the literature says, my colleagues said about those problems in other countries, are realizing that maybe they spin the opposite way in some aspects, like as was saying with water, I'm more and more convinced that local discussions on sustainability are the way to go and the way to build from there upwards. I'm not saying that IPCC type of initiatives are not necessary, but I think we need to balance them more with these bottom-up approaches.
And I think, you know, what you're pointing out also is that there's a lot of difference between water and carbon. So some things may work well for carbon and atmospheric issues, which are global, but water, local issues may be very important to consider in the context.
Yes, I think carbon perhaps blinded us about other aspects or other dimensions of sustainability, and also made us think that this global orchestration is possible. And I don't think it's not possible and it's not desirable. We need to think sustainability in all its dimensions. And carbon may be an important one for some societies, but in my own corner of the world, I wouldn't start there. I would start with water very often. I think water will connect us directly with what society is feeling and needing this right time. And that is the way to go, I think, to succeed with initiatives on sustainability.
Well, I think water security and food security are really high on the agenda these days, in addition to energy issues. And all of these things are connected, and we need to understand those interconnections and try to build a more resilient future. So thank you so much for discussing these topics, and it's fascinating to learn about Argentina, and would encourage listeners to view some of your documentaries. Our guest today was Dr. Esteban Jabali from San Luis University in Argentina, and hope that you enjoy this podcast. Thank you.
Thanks.